Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens, hosted by Nate Wilcox. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Facebook, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. This week, the legendary Stanley Booth joins Nate to discuss the difficult genesis of his masterpiece, The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones, and reveals what he saw in Brian Jones's eyes, what it was like being on stage at Altamont, and his life and death struggle to tell the story of the Stones. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. And today I've got the great honor of being joined once again by Stanley Booth. And today we're going to talk about The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones, a book which has been called, and I believe it to be true, the one authentic masterpiece of rock and roll writing. Stanley, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And this book is a classic, legendary account of the Rolling Stones' 1969 tour, which you accompanied them on, correct?
Yeah, and look, I have to toot my own horn here. A guy wrote a review in a newspaper in Arkansas and called me the Stones Boswell.
James Boswell was
the great biographer of Samuel Johnson, and I think being called the Stones Boswell is that I have to say that was a nice thing on his part.
And I have to agree, and I think I've read, if not all the Stones biographies, 95% of them, and this is by far. To me, it's in a separate category.
You have wasted a great deal of time, my friend.
I have, and I have to blame you, Stanley. I read your book when I was about 16 or 17, and you set me on this path of fascination with the Rolling Stones, in particular Brian Jones, from which I have barely recovered.
Well, Brian was a unique person, and I still miss Brian. Brian was, he was my friend, and he was, Brian and I were very close. I never had any problems with Brian. A lot of other people had problems with Brian. But I'll never forget that night that Joe Bergman called and told me that Brian had died. Because Brian was really, at heart, a very sweet person. But he could really be difficult, you know. And he was more difficult to himself than anybody else.
And you say in the book that on your first trip to England, when you went to Brian Jones' second drug trial, that you had only glimpsed the mystery of the Stones in his eyes. What did you mean about that, by seeing the mystery of the Rolling Stones in Brian Jones' eyes?
Well, I saw Brian on – Brian took the stand, and he looked up and our eyes met, and I saw this panic in his eyes, panic in the sense of the god Pan. And I knew that there was more to this story than I had anticipated.
And you spent the next several years digging to the bottom of that. And at one point, I want to quote a little thing you describe, a movie that you hallucinated in which you lay out the roles of the Stones as you would see them in your movie. You've got Bill Wyman, the sinister vicar, Charlie Watts, the mute but honest gravedigger, Brian, the wicked renegade, a mad, gleeful spirit of chaos hanging around the place, and Keith as Mick's evil alter ego. But you never define Mick Jagger's role, and he remains enigmatic through the whole thing.
That was because Mick and I were on a plane, and I was telling Mick the story, and I didn't want to, queer the deal. If you're describing a movie to Mick Jagger, in which Mick is a character, you got to step lightly,
And so now that I've got you here, what would Mick's character be?
And the thing is that I did have that vision. And, of course, it was something that could never happen because Brian was no longer, you know. But it made for interesting conversation on the pre-flight.
And it certainly makes for a vivid image, right? I got to ask again, what would Mick's role in your vision? Can you pull that back up, or is it lost?
He would have been, I suppose, the master of the estate, because, you know, Mick has to be master of wherever he is.
And you make that very clear.
Mick has to, at least in his own mind, be the boss.
And you make that very clear through the book, and you describe at one point you got to see Alan Klein and Mick Jagger having a discussion, if not quite an argument, but you say that you saw Mick dismiss Klein with a wave of his hand and realized then how powerful Mick was.
Right, yeah. It was interesting because at that time, Alan Klein appeared invincible. You know, he had the Beatles. He had, and Bob Dylan sent the Stones a telex. In those days, we used telexes. Something called a telex was kind of like a fax. And Dylan said, "Don't sign with this guy."
And they didn't listen.
Well, yeah. I mean, they signed with them, but they soon realized their error and they were kind of like, it was kind of like the situation with Stax and Atlantic. They were rock and rollers, right? They liked to rock and roll. They liked to have a good time. Their specialty was really not reading contracts, which is how Abco became the proprietor of all of that great early Stone stuff.
And you structured the book in an unusual way. And you talk in the afterward that the literary qualities of the book, at least the way they tried to market it, might have held it back. But let's talk about the structure of the book for a second. You start each section with, you know, new journalism, first person on the scene reporting from Altamont with the Stones. And then you go into a series of alternating chapters where it's sort of the adventures of Stanley Booth on the road with the Rolling Stones in 1969, alternating with chapters that are essentially the story of Brian Jones and the Rolling Stones. It's not that he dominates those.
It switches from our tour in 69 to, Brian was in a way the central figure, but what I was trying to do was just, without being boring, give the history of the band as they developed, there's prefacing passages were because I knew what was coming, you know. I knew that Altamont was coming, and I knew it was going to be awful. And that was one reason I tried as hard as I could to be funny every chance I got.
And that's essential because by starting the book in Altamont the night before their concert, their fatal concert, it puts this aura of doom and brooding over the whole book. And in the first couple of pages, you talk about Mick and Keith walking through the nighttime scene where all the kids are camped out getting ready for the show. And you say,
Mick and Keith and Ronnie and Tony Funches and I went out. And none of the rest of them had enough interest in the thing to even go out there, you know. And it was a question as we were leaving the Huntington Hotel. I mean, I remember I wanted to go because that's what I do. I hang out, I see things, I write them down. And and Mick was upstairs, and Keith was on the stairs, and he said, "Are you coming?" You know, it's like there was still a question even as we got into the limo to go out there, out to Altamont, of whether we were even going to bother to go.
And you get this quote in there, and it's not a quote, it's your description of how Mick and Keith are smiling. It's their little joke to have the power to create this huge gathering by simply wishing for it aloud and the freedom to walk like anybody else along the busy, barren path. And it's...
So it was, in a sense, a joke. It was also a measure of how little they knew about what they were about to get into.
And you paint that very clearly. Like, they had their experience to the Hells Angels was limited to their Hyde Park concert in London a few months earlier, where they had the English Hells Angels, who were not at all the same.
Yeah. The English Hells Angels are like Boy Scouts.
And then
the American Hells Angels are not like Boy Scouts, as you know.
Very, very clear. And I think it's telling. There's another quote in there from Shirley Watts, Charlie Watts' wife, and that, you know, you mentioned Charlie and Bill.
Whom I love, by the way. People have asked me, who's your favorite Rolling Stone? And I say, Shirley Watts.
That comes through in the book. But she says, you know, along the lines of Charlie and Bill not going out or Mick Taylor going out to see Altamont, that Charlie and Bill aren't really stones, are they? Mick, Keith, and Brian.
That's right. That's what she said. She said, you know, they were, and to her, and really to Charlie, they weren't part of that pop thing, you know? I mean, Charlie, like me, was just a jazz fan, you know? He was just somebody who played excellent brush drums and loved, the great jazz drummers. And that whole pop scene, and in fact, on the way back from Altamont, Mick and I were driving back to San Francisco to get a little few hours sleep before the gig the next day. And I said, I don't know, man, you believe in all this Generation Revolution hype a lot more than I do. And Mick denies it. He says, no, I don't really. But he really did. And he paid for it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And so you were already leery of that, but you were still engaged in some of the idealism and the optimism of that time.
Well, it was an optimistic time. It was an idealistic time. And at the end, I think Mick's character was born out because John James said that there are cops that are willing to take you out. And Mick said, no, I ain't going out with the cops.
And that outlaw imagery.
And I thought, you know, I put my arm around him because I thought this is a great guy.
and you use that outlaw imagery throughout the book when you describe being at the trial, Brian Jones's second trial in London in 68. And you describe a moment when Keith and Mick come into the trial for the first time. And you describe it as literally, you know, the younger brothers coming in to see Bob Younger.
Exactly right. Like Cole, Jim, and Bob. And as a matter of fact, I knew a guy in Memphis who was an artist, and his family owned property in Missouri. And there was a cave on the property, and somebody had written in soot on the wall, Cole, Jim, and Bob. And that's where that came from. I remembered that writing on the wall, and I thought, wow, these are those guys.
And so they put off that aura of brotherly togetherness at that point. Did you have any suspicion at that point for how deep the rifts were between the three of them?
Oh, no, not at all. No, they were so close. They were, I mean, look, you know, if you, I mean, if you and I were friends, and we were friends for 50 years, there would be times when we were not as close as we had been, right? You know, I mean, things happen. And sometimes, you know, things happen, you know, people get offended, people, you know, and they got old, you know. I mean, they're grandfathers, great-grandfathers now. I mean, you know, it all changes. Life changes. But no, I had no sense. I mean, we were all brothers at that point. We loved each other.
And you quote Stu Sutcliffe describing the closeness, the musical closeness of Brian and Keith. You quote him saying, Brian and Keith had this guitar thing like you wouldn't believe. There was never any suggestion
that's
of a lead.
That's what Stu said. Yeah.
A lead and a rhythm player.
And it was true because that was all they did. They stayed inside in that funky little apartment and played guitar until they had it down like one guitar player.
Yeah, two guitar players that were like somebody's right and left hand. And I want to play our first song, which is this is the Rolling Stones doing Jimmy Reed's Bright Lights, Big City at their very first recording session with Glenn John, something that was never commercially released. The Stones doing Bright Lights, Big City.
Wonderful. This is great. Thank you.
And that was the Stones, and that's one of the best examples of the early Stones with Brian Jones and Keith Richards playing like two guitarists or one guitarist with four hands.
That's right.
And so that kind of musical closeness, you just can't fake. I mean, you can hear the brotherhood between Keith and Brian, but the way Keith and Stu and others told you the story, it seemed like there was always like it was either Brian and Mick that were close or Keith and Brian that were close or Keith and Mick that were close. What do you make of that dynamic where it was always an uneven triangle?
I think that's just a basic human dynamic. I mean, if there are three people and they're all three friends, I think the dynamic is that two of them are close and they get not so close, and it, you know, it moves, it changes, but you know, at that time the situation was so fluid. I mean, they were just about to meet Andrew Oldham, and they were about to leave Eric Eastwood. It had been. Had visions of being their manager, and Brian was about to lie their way out of a recording contract. I mean, the whole idea was succeeding,
and they did what it took. And in the second chapter of the book, you open one of the first of your quotes. You've got a whole series of quotes, mainly about Buddy Bolden, the great New Orleans jazz player. But in the first chapter. In the second chapter, you have a quote from Mississippi Joe Calicott, which is he's describing a story where some of his musical partners were poisoned one and killed the other. They'd done it because he could play
poisoned
better than they could.
One and killed the other, yeah.
And then
he said, I'm going to want him to go to New York and play. He said, I'm going to be like a monkey. I ain't going.
And you end that chapter with saying with a quote from Anita Pallenberg, who says Brian's fall wasn't my fault or because of drugs. It was Mick and Keith.
Well, I mean, take that for what it's worth, you know.
Yeah, I knew there was not a lot to elaborate on there, but I had to get that quote in there. And also in that chapter, you describe interviewing Brian's parents, and you're one of the very few writers that got to them. They mention other writers coming to them, but I have read tons of Stones literature, and there are very few interviews with Mr. and Mrs. Jones. What was it like interviewing them in Cheltenham?
They were not easy to get to. They were not easy to talk to. They had, as far as they were concerned, a lot to be ashamed of, because they didn't want Brian to be a musician at all. They wanted him to work at Rolls Royce like his father, you know, or be a music teacher like his mother. I mean, this was not what they envisioned for their son, Brian. And Brian was, aside from being the great musician he was, he was gifted in many ways. He was a very, very good student, and he could have done many things. But he was in love with jazz the way the, you know, the rest of us nuts were in love with jazz, and that is, that turned out to be his destiny and his doom, I'm sorry to say.
And yeah, and his father describes all those talents and then says, so much talent wasted. And it's funny to think of somebody who's an internationally famous musician who changed the course of popular music history as a waste of talent, but that's all his father could see.
But to Lewis, Brian's father, it was wasted, because, I mean, look, my father wanted me to be an insurance salesman, you know. My parents wanted me to be a teacher, and I have been a teacher all my life in different ways, but not in the way they envisioned. And, you know, to Lewis Jones, Brian's father, Brian was just throwing his life away.
And in some sense, you know, he was right. I mean,
all 26, 27 years of it.
Yeah. And you've kind of already answered this question with your statement of Brian's eyes having the spirit of panic in him. But you talk about how much Lewis looked like his son, and the same posture, same frame, same short arms and small, strong hands, but without the quality of Brian's eyes of being lit from within.
Well, that is true. I mean, Brian's father didn't have that glamorous appearance, you know, with Brian's beautiful blonde hair and all that. But they did look very much alike physically.
And yet something was very different in there. And at one point in the book, Ian Stewart, says that even if there had never been an Ian Stewart or a Brian Jones or a Charlie or Bill, that Mick and Keith would still have had a band that looked and sounded very much like the Stones. But do you think they would have had that same element of panic of as in the great God Pan that Brian brought to the
band?
Well,
one would hope not. You know, Stu had a unique perspective on the Stones because, let's face it, I mean, they threw him out. You know, and Stu had the strength of character that even having been thrown out, he stayed and played brilliant piano on a lot of things. But I'll tell you what, man, Stu was a very strong person, but he really didn't care about being a pop star. What Stu cared about was playing golf. You know, and listening to Albert Ammons and Meat Loaf Lewis.
And he contributed so much, and he's a great source for you in the book. And once again, it's amazing all the people that you are able to get to open up, and some of the scenes you describe of being there in their rented house in Los Angeles. I think it was Peter Tork's house, from the Monkees.
Alexis Korner was very kind to me. You know, I think one reason people were so kind and open with me was that I obviously wasn't in it for the money.
Even though, as part of the book, you describe a lot of the business dealings you go through with your book.
Yeah. I mean, I did want to make a living. I wanted to survive, but it wasn't, to me, I wasn't trying to write a big pop book and be like you know, have it be like that. I just wanted to tell the truth and have it, you know, my attitude in going into writing the book was that if somebody picked this book up 100 years from now and never heard of the Rolling Stones, I wanted them to find the characters interesting in themselves.
And you absolutely succeeded. And at one point, you mentioned that Joe Bergman, who was a major operator in the Stones organization, although, as you say, it's never exactly clear what she did. And you even say she didn't know exactly what she did.
They didn't know and she didn't know. I mean, that was typical of the Stones. You know, nobody knew exactly what was going on.
And she tells you at some point, long after you've already committed to this project, that she had been told by a fortune teller, I believe, that you would write the book, but that it would cost you everything.
Except my life.
Except your life. And from your telling, it pretty much did. Tell us some of the price you paid to come back with this.
Well, I lost people from my life. I lost, you know, you lose lovers, you lose, yeah, I mean, the thing about writing that book was that it was so dark. You know, I knew the ending was going to be so dark, and I was just trying to make it not just be a an unpleasant, sad experience for the reader. You know, I wanted it to be true, but I didn't want it to be just and to use the parlance of the time, I didn't want it to be just a bummer, you know?
Yeah, and I think your method of telling the story from the scene, you know, moment by moment, it keeps it light and lively because people like Keith Richards are always saying funny shit.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so let's hear another song. This is the Rolling Stones from their last tour with Brian Jones in Europe in 1967 doing Yesterday's Papers. That was the Stones, 1967, doing a live version of Yesterday's Papers. And that, you know, we've heard the beginning and the end of the Brian Jones era with the band. And the rest of the show will be...
Where was that from? Where was that live track from?
That was in Paris, I believe. Okay. And they do it... Okay.
You know, the Stones were the first rock and roll band to go behind the Iron Curtain. Because they went to Warsaw, and one of the editions of my books has a sheaf of photographs of the Stones playing in Warsaw, Poland. And I always thought that was cool, that even though they were not politically inclined or interested in politics, they were the first band to go behind the Iron Curtain and show them what freedom looked like, you know?
And triggered a riot about as big as the ones that they had triggered in Denmark, in West Germany a couple of years earlier. So, the rest of the, most of the book though takes place in the Mick Taylor era of the Rolling Stones. And which a lot of people consider their greatest musical accomplishment because, you know, everything from Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, Exile, Main Street.
Little Mick was a brilliant musician, and I'm sure he asked himself every night, why did I leave that band?
And yet he's alive to ask that question, which he might not be, yet he stayed.
Yeah, exactly.
And Little Mick is kind of a ghostly presence in the book, but you've got a quote in there from Bill Wyman that talks about the difference between the Brian Jones years and Mick Taylor. And he says that, you know, Keith has a habit of turning his amp up all the way through the show. And when Brian was there, Brian would just turn his amp up just as loud, whereas Mick says you're playing too loud and tries to get him to turn down, which is a futile quest.
Exactly.
And so, but they also, you know, we talk about the riots they trigger, and you describe an early riot that they experienced in Blackpool, where the Glaswegians
Stu says it's the toughest town in the world. And I said, in the world? And he said, oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a German word that means Glaswegian that translates literally as poison dwarf. And so they've faced him in a number of wars and know what they're dealing with.
I mean, and every instrument got destroyed. It was sheer havoc, you know. But that was the scene at the time. I mean, they were just a part of this mad force, societal force they had to, for one thing, they had to survive it. And it all changed. It's completely different now, but who thought they were going to last over 50 years? You know, the girl I am going to marry, Alexandra, who was born in 1986, by the way.
Congratulations.
Her father saw them in Chicago a few days ago. At Soldiers Field, along with 60,000 other people, and you know, and they did Play with Fire, they did Paint It Black, they did songs. I have never, even all the times I've seen them, I've never seen them do those songs. And I thought, well, you know, if I couldn't be there to see it, at least Alex and her dad could see it.
And you know, the difference when you go and see the Stones now, and it's a crowd with a lot of salt and pepper hair in the audience, is very different. It's hard to imagine what it was like in the 60s. But when you describe the Blackpool riot, you have a sentence that you added, what difference does it make whether one is being torn apart by one's enemies or one's friends?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah, and it makes me think of Orpheus, you know, and being ripped apart by the worshippers of Dionysius, his fans, essentially.
Exactly. I mean, you go down that pit, and you're just likely not to come out alive.
And throughout the book, you tell little snippets or quotes from people writing about the great Buddy Bolden, who's the never recorded precursor of King Oliver and Louis Armstrong in New Orleans jazz.
Well, now we don't know for certain that he never recorded. There may somewhere be a cylinder of Buddy Bolden, and if we find it, I'm going to sell it.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed that somebody finds it. But you picked Buddy Bolden. What was connection?
He was the Ur figure. He was the mad artist. He went nuts there's this connection between madness and this music that has always been there, and it's interesting to see that it really didn't happen to the Stones. I mean, they're millionaires, but there was a genuine danger there.
And that's one thing that you sort of play up, a theme that the Stones are sort of playing with fire. And we mentioned already that they didn't know what they were dealing with, but you've got the quotes from the press conference where Mick first starts musing about the idea of a free concert, but in a very evasive way, and maybe we can do something for the people. Did you see it at the time, or was that something you realized later, that the extent to which mixed casualness about a free concert was going to lead to disaster or trouble?
It was casual in a way, and there was no, I mean, look, they had done this tour, and they had not done a tour for 3 years, and they were simply trying to do something to say thank you for the fans. And I mean, and there's all that stuff that people say about the songs waited for nightfall, you know, and they invited the Hell's Angels. They didn't invite the Hell's Angels to do anything. It was a free concert. Anybody could come, and about 500 Hell's Angels came and behaved like Hell's Angels.
And yet you talk about another thread that you weave through the book is Mix messianic. There's even a point at which you quote Joe Bergman saying Mix recently come across the word messianic, and he's quite fascinated mm-hmm. with it.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, that's something that was
I would say, rather unfortunate that Mick kind of hooked onto that concept.
And yet, at the time, I mean, and you've got this quote from a broadsheet that was being passed out in Oakland, which, you know, the mm-hmm. Bay Area was one of the big hotbeds of 60s radicalism. And right. It's this, you know, six-paragraph manifesto basically putting the Stones in the position as if they're the leaders of the Che Guevara of a youth revolution. I mean, do you think it was just unavoidable that they would get caught up to some extent in believing that hype?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. I intended that my quoting that sheet was intended to be ironic, because they really, I mean, they weren't trying to be social revolutionaries. They were just trying to, you know, as I say at Altamont, they were just trying to do a nice thing for their fans. And they, if they had known, which they did not, what the American Hell's Angels were like and what they were capable of, they wouldn't have done it. We wouldn't have gone there. We would not have done that. And, you know, I think we would have been just as well off not to do it. Now, I have said that I thought we should have done it again the next night. But I think I've kind of retreated from that position.
And you describe it at one point in the book as saying the biggest group of playmates in history was having recess with no teachers to protect them from the bad boys, the bullies, who may have been mistreated children and worthy of understanding, but would nevertheless kill you. The Stones' music was strong, but it could not stop the terror.
That's right. Did I write that?
You wrote that, Stanley. You nailed it. And I know it's hard to follow something up because you nailed it there in the quote I just read. But You know what?
That's not bad. That's pretty good.
And the whole book is full of this, folks. It's a good 380 pages of just classic. And at one point you said that you wanted every word of dialogue to sound like it could have come out of Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe's mouth.
I did. I love Raymond Chandler. You know, and as much as I love Raymond Chandler, I admire Dashiell Hammett even more, but I'm not crazy enough to think I can write as well as Dashiell Hammett. But I did get to where I could almost write like Ray Chandler.
And yeah, and this book is beautifully written all the way through. And you've got this conversation in here of you and Mick and Keith after Altamont and Mick's shock. You know, he's saying Mick sat on a wooden bench, eyes still hurting, angry, bewildered and scared, not understanding who the Hell's Angels were or why they were killing people at his free peace and love show. How could anybody think those people are good, think they're people you should have around? And like, but yeah. The Angels had been the hippies, you know, from Ken Casey and the Grateful Dead, and the Dead Rock Scully probably did invite the Angels, but not the Stones. But I mean, they had been flirting with the Angels on and off for several years, even after the Angels had turned on them at some of the free speech rallies.
Yeah, and of course, Hunter Thompson had written A Strange and Terrible Saga about the Angels. And the dead had the Angels at some of their gigs, and so there was a relationship there in San Francisco, a pre-existing relationship that was but the Stones were not part of that. They were not part of an ethos, and it all turned into Meredith Hunter was right in front of my face when he was stabbed to death by that Angel, and nobody expected it to turn into the horror it became.
And the next song I'm going to play is the Stones doing I'm Free at their London Hyde Park concert in 1969. This is I'm Free. We'll hear it and then ask Stanley about that song. I'm Free, the first time Mick Taylor had played it live with the Stones. And that song is sort of a sore subject for you in the book. You talk about it over and over again and sort of wrestle with the implications of it and them playing it. Talk a little about that song and why it sort of stuck in your craw that whole tour.
Well, I mean, I'm Free is it's an enormous thing to say. It's a very... it's a huge declaration, and I didn't get along particularly well with Glenn Johns, but Glenn Johns said what I must agree with. When he says I'm free, he's talking out his arse.
And yeah, I mean, he's declaring freedom that he can't have. And
that he can't have, that nobody can have. I mean, certainly not under those circumstances. But, I mean, Mick, I love him. He's my friend. We've known each other forever. But he has written some really bad songs, and he is quite willing to do them, you know.
and you've got a scene in there where you're talking to a woman named Kathy that knew the Stones, and she says, Mick used to play act and tell everybody to fuck off. Now I'm being myself and everybody tells me to fuck off. He's so great. He's natural and sweet when we're alone. But when one other person could come in and he's completely different and you can't communicate with him at all.
Like, that is very true. That is very true. If it's Kathy of Kathy and Mary, the groupie duo, if you and Mick were talking right now, it would be the way you and I are talking. You know, we're just talking. You know, we're not trying to impress anybody. We're not being particularly anything except just straightforward and honest, but one other person can come in, and Mick is Mick Jagger is the most insecure person in the world, and why that should be the case, I really have never been able to figure out. Because how hard can, as Keith asked me once, how hard can it be to be Mick Jagger?
Well, apparently it's pretty difficult, and only one person has gotten to walk that road. And the way you structure the book, it's got the effect of basically like two plot lines that both reach a climax at the same time. And that you said you architected it that way deliberately, that the disaster at Altamont and the funeral of Brian Jones are tied together to happen at the same point. And it's like you say with your struggle, I mean, it's almost overwhelming. And you describe Shirley Arnold, who was the head of the Stones fan club and one of the true only basically innocent people in this whole story.
Radio interview, please.
Thank you. And she tells you her story of her experience of his funeral, and she doesn't quite fall into the grave, but metaphorically does.
Right. Yeah. That to me that was extremely effective. That Shirley, who had been so close to Brian, felt herself descending into that pit, and of course it was just a mental impression, but it was I thought it made a powerful ending for a chapter at least.
Absolutely, and it ties back into a scene that you had described to you earlier by William Burroughs and Brian Gysin, who had taken Brian around in Morocco, and while he was recording the Master Musicians of Shizuoka, they were at a feast, and there was a white goat. And when Brian first saw the white goat, he leaps up and says, "That's me." And then later on, he realizes that a few hours later, they've eaten that same goat. And his comment is, "It's like communion." Did you?
Yeah, and I pointed out that Jesus did not eat himself; he fed the others. And Burroughs, God bless him, said, "Next time I see Graham Greene, I'm going to eat him." Gulp.
And that's pretty perfect, and it captures William Burroughs in a nice thumbnail portrait. But did you? I mean, you're dealing with a subject where you've got one character that you're calling messianic, or at least saying that he's flirting with being messianic, and another character who is sort of the sacrifice. And how conscious were you of the Jesus and Christian imagery, and also the Dionysius myth? I mean, he's killed and brought back to life. I mean, how much were you conscious of what you were playing with, and how much of it was just coming out?
Oh, well, I'm not sure I quite understand that. They were all different. They were all, I mean, it's amazing that this band has stayed together all these years because they were so radically different from each other. And I mean, that must have had something to do with the dichotomy between Mick and Keith that led the band to separate for years, you know. But as Keith said, it's bigger than both of us. So they dragged it back together. I saw a TV interview with Charlie, and Charlie said that, you know, if we said we'll retire, we'll hang it up, it wouldn't bother me. And it wouldn't. I mean, Charlie would be perfectly happy to stay home with Shirley and hang around and play with his jazz records, you know.
But Mick seems to need to go on, and we've kind of maybe given Keith short shrift in this conversation, but in a lot of ways, he's the Stone that you know the best in the book. He comes through the best, you spend the most time with him, and yet he's still pretty enigmatic. I mean, in your vision, you know, you call Keith Mick's evil alter ego, but Keith really comes across as more sympathetic than Mick. Why the evil alter ego with Keith?
I probably shouldn't have said that. Keith and I became very close very quickly, and I think it's partly because we liked the same things. We liked blues, we liked girls, we liked drugs, but we just Keith and I had a great similarity of character, I would say, because we neither of us have any diplomacy whatsoever, and you know, if something comes up, we say it. And I mean, it's like when we're at the restaurant in New York, and Keith says, "We're going to the Deep South." And I said, "Oh, yeah, and what, in your opinion, is the Deep South?" Like, as if you know, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and, but Keith likes that. I mean, and I like it. I like for people to be honest. And, so we, you know, we're somehow, miraculously, we're still friends.
And let's hear one last song. This is the Stones at Altamont doing Under My Thumb. And that was the Rolling Stones at Altamont. Mick Jagger heard at the beginning of that track, trying to calm the crowd. And you were right there when Meredith Hunter was killed. Did you realize at that moment that, like, Keith was on stage and could tell something bad had happened, but did you have any idea how bad until later, or did you know right away?
Well, I think the Mazels brothers and Charlotte Zwerin did a brilliant job putting together Gimme Shelter, the DVD, the documentary about the 69 tour. But it gives a false impression of what actually happened. Gimme Shelter makes you think that a guy got killed and everybody split. What happened was a guy got killed and nobody knew he had died. And the Stones stayed there for at least another solid hour and played one of the most brilliant concerts of the tour. They were absolutely heroic. And I have the tape of what they did that night. And, I mean, anybody else would have turned and run. And they stayed there and played like geniuses, like angels.
And kept the crowd calm, or as calm as they could, and delivered their show.
Yeah, well, I mean, no. The weird thing was that the crowd calmed. The crowd became calm. And it wasn't, it was, I'm sure it had something to do with the brilliance of the song's performance. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, there wasn't any anything magical going on. It was just that the Stones played so well and everybody settled down and listened.
It was
an incredible thing. And I love what Graham said when we were back at the Huntington Hotel. And Mick and Keith is making say, how can anybody say how they're good people or they're good to be around? And Graham says the angels are just a bunch of bozos.
And that's a fair enough description. And I want to get one last question, and it's kind of complicated, but in the book you describe both Marianne Faithfull, who was Mick Jagger's soon to be ex, and Anita Pallenberg as, in the one case, Marianne Faithfull, after Brian's death, went to Australia with Mick to film a movie and took an overdose of pills and had a hallucination that she saw Brian in the mirror. And you described the sort of vision she had of she and Brian in the afterworld, and Brian essentially sent her back. And Anita, you describe as saying that she thought that her child with Keith Marlin would be Brian reincarnated, and described that she kept pictures of Brian up in their bedroom. I mean, the women of the Stones are openly haunted by Brian Jones's death. Did you see that with Mick and Keith, or was it just sort of a shadow lurking
around? Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I was in their bedroom, and I saw this picture of Brian on a chest of drawers in a gold frame. It wasn't a great big picture. It was just a picture of Brian, but they were very. And the thing that Anita said, you know, it wasn't. It was Mick and Keith. I mean, they were very open about what had happened and whose role was what.
Yeah, and it's heavy and haunting and has haunted us as a culture for 50 years. And Stanley Booth, the book is The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones. And like it says on the book jacket, the one authentic masterpiece of rock and roll writing, hands down, I think the best book, greatest book. It's beyond rock and roll. To me, it's a key book in American literature. So, Stanley, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been an honor.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, I don't often pick that book up, but when I do pick it up and look at it and read a little bit, I have to say I'm not ashamed of it.
I'm damn right. And thank you, Stanley.
Thank you.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Facebook, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. Nate will be back next week with Ted Gioia to talk about the jazz standards. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones is published by Chicago Review Press and is out in a new audiobook edition. Please support our show by ordering via the Amazon referral link on our website, letitrollpodcast.com.